Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice. Today, we have something a little different. We have a panel discussion with three very well-known and very competent economists.
That's right, Mona. We've got three great economists on today's panel. We have Kimberly Atterbury, Dave Evans, and Scott Barnhart. Kimberly is a president of Vermilion Consulting, LLC. Vermilion helps varied organizations in the public and private sectors leverage the benefits of the federally mandated EB-5 program. Her company provides expert advice on project feasibility, such as EB-5 compliance structure, job creation methodology, and targeted employment area analysis. Kimberly Atterbury, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
And we also have Dave Evans. Dave has over three decades of experience in economics and modeling. He currently leads the economic impact practice at Evans, Carroll, and Associates, and has prepared numerous EB-5 economic impact reports receiving USCIS approval, and has also developed custom economic impact models for projects outside of the 50 states. Dave, welcome to EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Scott Barnhart. Scott is the president of Barnhart Economic Services, LLC, a consulting firm employing PhD economists specializing in EB-5 and non-EB-5 economic job creation studies, business plans, targeted employment area designations, and legal consulting services. Scott is also the co-owner of Florida First Regional Center and New York City EB-5 Regional Center. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It sounds like it's going to be a very interesting session.
So, panel, you have to guess what my first question is going to be. This was the topic, well, prior to COVID, I would say, this was really the topic on everybody's mind, of course, the new TEA changes back from November 21st, 2019. All right, so we have a number of questions, actually, which I have for you, which are real questions from real projects and investors and in developers. But prior to that, let me just ask each of you, have you started doing TEA classifications, Kim?
Yes. Oh, yes. We've done them for a long time. And we have developed a letter that is now submitted in place of state documentation. And it's been an interesting change and quite a process to go through.
Do you need a state letter as well?
No, you do not. And in fact, I think the states are very happy to have washed their hands of the TEA problem that they had to deal with. They weren't really sure how to deal with it. A lot of states were not. In fact, we were actually a subcontractor for a couple of states and produced their TEA letters for them. But no, you do not need a state TEA letter, nor can you get one.
Scott, what was really the thought process behind the whole making the TEA stricter, you know, the whole gerrymandering issue?
Well, I think that USCIS wanted a somewhat of a more restricted model because there was some gerrymandering. And I'm going to guess everyone, each economist on this panel is going to say, yeah, that one was a bit of a stretch, but it worked for our client. And so, you know, where there were a number of, I mean, I guess I should say they were the exception rather than the rule, where you strung together, let's say, maybe 25 or 30 different census tracts. But I will also say, I mean, so that was their impetus. And, you know, the impetus that, I mean, the fact that 99% of all projects were in a high unemployment area, including those in Beverly Hills, those in Manhattan, et cetera, et cetera. So I think Congress was complaining about that. But I will also go the other side. I do believe that they, you know, were warranted in scaling back and coming up with an alternative rule. But what they've got now is just plain, I won't call it stupid, I'll just call it silly.
Well, Scott, by the way, what exactly is gerrymandering?
Okay, so gerrymandering, the way it's been, the connotation in this field is just, you know, stringing together an endless or a large number of census tracts to get the high unemployment rate that you need for your project. So basically, the project is not in a high unemployment area. And so you string together or you combine census tracts, calculate the unemployment rate for the combined area rather than the project tract. And then that counts as a high unemployment area. So for New York, you would often jump the river and go over to Brooklyn or other places, like, you know, around the airport to get tracts. And then actually New York's trick was to go, if you were in Southern Maine.
Trick, Scott?
Well, no, I won't say trick. It was a good idea when I saw what they did. I thought, wow, why didn't I think of that? What they did.
Inspiring.
In Lower Manhattan, and they went straight through Central Park up to Harlem instead of wrapping around the park.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's a good idea. I would have never, you know, I would have thought that you would have objected to that if I had done it.
So, Dave, I'm going to ask you, just because there must be many of our listeners out there who really don't understand what the changes are or what the different classification is from pre-November 21 to now. Can you explain it, please, for the audience?
Sure. The big difference, Scott was alluding to, is that you could take the census tract where your project was located and then string together as many census tracts as you needed to form a high unemployment area, as long as they all connected. In the new rules, either the census tract in which your project is located needs to be high unemployment, or you can also include other census tracts, but only those that are directly adjacent to the project census tract. So whereas before, there were situations where, and again, it was the exception, not the rule, right? But there were cases where we need to put together 20-some census tracts to form a high unemployment area. Now we can only use the census tract for the project located and the adjacent ones, which is generally going to be no more than 8 or 9 at the very most.
Thanks, Dave. That really leads me into some of the questions that we have. So I'm going to ask these questions, and any one of your panel can just jump in and answer. The first question that I have, and again, these are actual projects. If a situ area is situated close to a park, like Central Park within a city, can that be classified as rural?
This is Dave. The definition of rural doesn't have to do with whether it's near a park like that. It has to do with basically being outside of a metropolitan statistical area and with a population of less than 20,000. And that's the same as before.
Okay.
So that part of it has not changed.
So then if that particular project, which is next to a park, would still have to go back and do a proper TEA calculation?
That's right. If it's near Central Park, that's obviously in the New York City metropolitan area. And then it would be a matter of whether the project census tract and or the adjacent census tracts could be put together to form a high unemployment area.
Okay.
Mona, this is Scott. I wanted to finish up one thought, if I could, about
of course.
The change. So as Dave mentioned, you know, it's these tracts that are, it's either the project tract or those that are directly adjacent, meaning they have to touch the project tract. Now, that makes it much more closer or in a high unemployment area. But I'm going to tell you, when you look at like a city in California, like Los Angeles, it just makes no sense whatsoever. And I will also point out California's the rule prior to this, the state had a reasonable approach to it. They said you can use more than one track, but you can use 12 only. You know, you could go off in one direction or another. You didn't have to be directly adjacent. But I'll tell you, like in Los Angeles, we've got multiple hotel projects there. Literally in Los Angeles, you could walk to work from a high unemployment track to get to the project track, yet no tracks around the project that were directly adjacent to the project track were high unemployment. So literally a city block away was a very high unemployment rate. And the whole city is inundated with areas like that. So I think they've gone too far. And I think a more reasonable approach would be what the state of California had prior to the November change, and that was using a total of 12 tracks.
That's an interesting point because, and Kim, perhaps you could throw your two cents in this, but what was being said prior to November 21? There was all these blog pieces being said that, oh, that's it. There's going to be no more projects within inner cities. It's all going to be rural. I know ILW sent out quite a few of those type of comments, but we actually have found a number of tracks within cities. I mean, even New York City has a TEA track, which sort of snakes in the Lower East Side.
That's absolutely right. And I did want to just briefly pile on to what Scott was saying. The new rule is really arbitrary because let's be honest, if you are an unemployed person, you are going to do everything you can and you don't care about census tracts. You're going to get on a bus, you're going to get on a subway, you're going to walk, whatever. You're going to try to get to work and you really don't care if it's two census tracts away or three. That just doesn't make any sense. But to your point, you're right. Everybody was very worried that we would only be looking at rural projects from now on. And that's certainly not the case. It has become much more difficult, but we're working right now on projects in major metropolitan areas all over the U.S. It's more difficult now, but it's certainly not impossible.
So we actually haven't seen anything yet sent to USCIS and rejected. And the other big worry was, because the onus is on the project, what happens once you have everybody in and it does get rejected? I mean, what provisions have you made for the TEAs? You know, have you done things like opportunity zones as well, or just stuck to census tracts?
Well, with us, we have stuck with census tracts. What I try to do in anything that we submit to USCIS is I make sure that I present a reasonable argument that I can defend using economic theories or just straight statistics. I mean, TEAs are just a function of math. The numbers are the numbers. And while you can use, you know, there's a variety of data sources we can use now, there's really not that much. It's pretty straightforward. So we just try to lay it all out in the letter to where USCIS doesn't have an opportunity to quibble with it.
Dave, Scott, do you either of you have anything to chime in on this point?
This is Dave. Same thing as Kim. We're sticking with the census tracts. And really, there's two main methods that are recommended for calculating TAAs, you know, either using the combination of data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the American Community Survey, or just using American Community Survey data. And there was some talk of, well, they didn't say you have to use those two, but it was implied. So, you know, as we do this for our clients, say, hey, we're going to use one of these two methods, and those are the ones that they're recommending. And it really should be ironclad because, as Kim said, the data is the data.
So this is Scott, and I would like to just add on to that. And I think this is the consensus, what Dave just said among economists. I think it's sort of an unwritten rule. He mentioned two data sources, which USCIS did mention, and it was the American Community Survey, which is typically a five-year snapshot of the census tract data. But you can get smaller periods of time than five. You can get up to 1 year, but they recommend using a longer period. And the other source is the Laos data on county data, or it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Local Area Unemployment Statistics. So in the past, like 95% of all the states would use something known as the census share method. And what they would do is, because the census tract data is older in the American Community Survey, which is what the census tract data is that we use, the updated Bureau of Labor Statistics data was for the county. So you would combine those two sources of data to come up with this census share method that is written out by the BLS, and you would get an updated, quote unquote, census tract unemployment rate. When they made this new adoption, they said you could use American Community Survey or Laos data. So then we all started sort of collectively, uncollectively, started thinking, you know, maybe you can just use the ACS alone, as well as combining it with the Laos data. That hasn't been tested, as far as I know, that ACS only. This, if you want a sure bet, most of the economists are still going with the census share, which combines the two sources.
Okay. So we have a situation now. Now that the amount has gone to 900 and there might be a location, so there are a lot of projects where the location is definitely not a TEA and it's at 1.8. So the scenario that I'm going to ask each one of you, the same scenario, is what happens if a business is bifurcated? So we have part of a business which was under the old rules and it's now in a non-TEA area. There are some employees still working there, but now that company has changed its major office where the employees are paid to a TEA location. Do you think that would work under the new rules, Scott?
No, I don't think so. I think they've already ruled on that. And it's really where, I mean, again, I could be proven wrong, but I think that it's really where the project and the jobs are located.
So if we say that the jobs are now split, Kim, do you think that would work if in the new sort of phase two of this project, some of the jobs are in the new TEA, even though some of them are still in the old TEA, but the payments are all coming from the new TEA?
Yeah, I agree with Scott. I think that's really kind of skirting the concept of where they're principally doing business. Where the paycheck comes from is really irrelevant. I mean, in that case, you could have some third party paycheck provider, you know, located in a completely different state, you know, somebody that has that kind of payroll service. But I really think that you need to look at the heart of the business. What is the business? What do they do? And who are the people that do it? Are the people that do it the ones that write paychecks, or are the people that do it the ones that are in the warehouse? And I think that's how USCIS would look at it.
Dave, let me give you a different spin on this same situation. What if the actual business, say it's a brand new project, they're not shovel ready to move forward, but they need to start because they want to apply for EB-5 money. They have EB-5 investors and they want to apply for them, and they don't need a larger office space just yet. They can manage with something small. Say it's a technology or maybe it's a manufacturing business. What happens then if they get one location, say it's in a TEA, and then their actual location, which is in a larger office, may not be in a TEA later, or is it another TEA? Would that work?
Yeah, again, it's kind of pushing the envelope. I mean, the language and the guidance is pretty clear on this point. It says where you're principally doing business. It's basically, you know, where is the company principally doing business, and is that a TEA or not? It almost doesn't matter if there are other parts of the business that are kind of the non-principal part, whether it's the paycheck writer or whoever. If in your example, the location where they were principally doing business changed, then there could be an opportunity to use the new location then if that was the main location at that point. But otherwise, I think it probably wouldn't fly.
Okay, thank you. From there, there's only a little hop and a skip and a jump, and we're at COVID. Because from November, there wasn't really much time to really fret about the TEA before we got slammed with COVID. And then since COVID, oh my God, I have so many questions to ask you guys. Number one, which everyone is asking us, are we going to see a change in the TEAs because of COVID?
I don't see any reason for that. I don't see why they would change that.
Why do you say that, Scott? Because what about all of these places like a hotel where they're just out of business now?
Well, I mean, they've never had any kind of regulation or stipulation about or guidance about what happens if there's a recession, for example. And this is just a big recession. I mean, the one thing that they could do is do some sort of Hail Mary type pass for projects that, I mean, let's face it, if you look at any of the sectors that are severely down, such as all the travel, hospitality, restaurants, et cetera, many of them have suspended interest payments because their occupancy is down so much.
Yeah.
They could do some sort of postponement of the job creation or some sort of rule that just said, okay, this is a situation that was outside of your control. And, you know, it's sort of like what the Fed is doing, what the federal government.
Right. They changed the a lot of the securities issues because of COVID. Maybe USCIS might do that for the TEAs. The argument that a lot of developers have come to us with or have spoken to us about is the fact that why would the census track, why would the unemployment not change now? Would that not be a proposition?
Yeah, Mona, this is David. I've gotten a lot of questions from clients as well, worrying that their area, which actually is a TEA today, might not be, just because, you know, COVID hit some areas a lot harder than others. You know, unemployment rates are going to be a lot different than they were. The thing is, even if you use Laos or the census share method that Scott was talking about, the fundamental data behind that is from the American Community Survey, which is five-year data. And actually, the latest data as of today is 2014 to 18. So the 2015 to 19 ACS data will be available later this year. It won't be until about a year and 3 months that the ACS data will encompass 2016 to 2020. All right, so we're talking about quite a while before there's any hint of COVID in the unemployment data at all from the ACS side. So my guidance has generally been, yes, we'll watch it, and there is some risk of that. But, you know, with the underlying data being on kind of a delay as well as a five-year period, it's unlikely that even a high unemployment spike somewhere is likely to take something that was a TEA out of TEA range. Not impossible, just unlikely.
Well, David, the point also is that there was an article on Bloomberg about this also, that the real recession isn't even going to hit us until January of 2021. And if that's the case, then all of these numbers will change, no?
That's right. To the extent that you don't even see some of the unemployment spikes until later, then it would be even longer before we'd see how it impacts these five-year unemployment numbers. So again, it's conceivable that something that was just barely a TEA, and maybe it wasn't as hard hit by COVID as some other areas, may no longer be a TEA. But like I said, I think people were kind of over worried about the risk, not being aware that there's this kind of a five-year average unemployment that underpins how a TEA is determined.
I'd like to add something too, that most of the clients that I'm hearing from are more thinking, well, hey, my project wasn't in a TEA before. Shouldn't it be high unemployment? But the issue really is, you know, you have to be, or the project has to have an unemployment rate that's 150% of the national average. Well, you know, the project track might be going up, but so is the national average. So,
right.
You know, both sides are moving.
And I just wanted to add on to what Scott and Dave were saying. What Scott said there is exactly the point. It depends on whether your project area is increasing or decreasing, how it's increasing or decreasing relative to the nation. So if it's worse off than the nation, then that could be a good thing, but it also could be a bad thing. It's really hard to, we all remember the days of having to work up to a TEA benchmark of, you know, 15, 16% back in 2008. And so, and that was really hard for a lot of census tracts to, you know, manage. So we're going to see some more of that. And we also have significant data lag. And so it is going to be quite some time before we really can see the impacts of this.
And this is Scott one more time. There is some thinking that we could use rolling averages, okay?
Oh, that's interesting. What's a rolling average?
Well, just using, instead of the BLS being a year, maybe 1 year, 9 months, 6 months, people have looked at that and it does add some higher unemployment. But again, it also is counterbalanced by the higher national average. I'm looking at one right now where it's not going to work because the national average is rising faster than the tract.
Yeah. Right, and right. One more comment on rolling averages. You have to make sure that it is a 12-month rolling average. USCIS will crush you if you're not using 12 months. It has to be 12 months only. And so you can just pick your start and stop date of your 12 months. So like June to July instead of January to December, something to that effect. That's what Scott was getting at.
Dave, you had a point?
I was actually going to say the same thing that Kim was. So there's been some discussion of maybe using rolling 12-month periods, and that could work. We don't know. What we know won't fly is sort of just picking a few months or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for all three of you, which you could throw back at me and say, well, hey, this is for the attorneys and not for us. We are working and we are trying to approach a couple of congressional people to see if we could change the definition, at least temporarily, of a troubled business. There is a difference between a troubled business and the troubled projects, because we are seeing troubled projects who are worrying about whether or not the jobs will be created during this period. Do you have any comments?
This is Dave. I mean, some of what we're seeing is that clients are realizing they may not hit the job counts that they were hoping for, either due to COVID or something that happened in the past, like they scaled back their project. Unfortunately, they're kind of looking for economists to wave their magic wand and save the day.
Of
and
course.
Come up with an extra 100.
You mean, Dave, you don't have a magic wand? What kind of economist are you?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, there's a little bit we can do, right? I mean, maybe there were some EB-5 eligible expenditures that weren't counted initially because they were relatively small and didn't seem necessary, and those can be included. Sometimes you can use a more recent year of multipliers, like actually since RIMS started using 2012 as a national benchmark rather than 2007, which they started doing with the 2017 multipliers. In some cases, you do see a little bit of a benefit by using more recent multipliers, but that's kind of hit and miss. Sometimes that actually reduces the job count. I guess for folks listening, you know, the jobs really have to be there. You can't just expect to be a couple hundred short and then have some miracle economic method pull you out of it.
Yeah. Kim?
I agree completely. It's not a good position to be in. And we use some of the same methods to try to squeak out a few more jobs here and there. Sometimes there are expenditures that were not considered previously that could be the same with using an updated set of RIMS, because then you don't have to deflate so far back. There's some little tricks that can potentially be done. But again, it's like the TEA. The numbers are the numbers. And so it often, I guess that we just didn't get issued the magic wands that we were supposed to when we finished our education.
And then there's one other thing that people might be thinking, and I, you know, even though I would like to say, sure, come my way, I'm 100% positive USCIS would not approve this, but
you're going to say it anyway, Scott.
No, well, I'm going to say what it's generally, we've found that relative to RIMS, IMPLAN has higher multipliers, especially induced ones. You know, there's three types of multipliers: direct, indirect, and induced. Those are that give you the different effects. And I've compared them. But let's say your project is now sucking wind and, you know, you've got a hotel and nobody's staying at your hotel and you're worried about generating the jobs. Well, you could have been conservative and based the jobs on construction only, or not as much on income, but we usually include both construction and income. You can't just say, okay, well, I used RIMS before, and now I'm going to just switch and go to IMPLAN. And I'm pretty sure if you did that and they connected the, and USCIS connected the dots, they would deny that. Would you agree with that, Kim or and Dave?
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, sometimes we have used RIMS to back up IMPLAN in a later filing, just to kind of validate it if the original IMPLAN analysis wasn't terribly transparent. And that has been accepted. It wasn't really a change, though, you know, a change of method. It was just a backup of what had already been provided. But I think you're right. They would probably shut that down.
Yeah, I would agree with you guys as well. And one thing they've even explicitly said in the guidance is that you can't kind of cherry pick your multipliers. So you can't say, well, we'll use the 2010 multiplier for construction, and then we'll use the 2017 multiplier for, you know, for the income, because that work, you know, those all work better. I mean, you've got to pick one year and go with that. And like I said, sometimes a more recent year can help, sometimes it doesn't, but it's really pretty limited what can be done there.
And one other thing I'd mention about USCIS that I find very peculiar.
Just one? Okay, I won't give them too much grief today.
There's no learning process. You know what I mean? So let's say all three of the economists on this panel submitted the same project, and maybe we were trying to get a regional center for the entire state of Florida or New York or something, and we use different methodology. And let's say that they rejected two of ours, but accepted the third. They would never say, hey, you know, we rejected yours because you did this and that, but this other guy we accepted. So why don't you just do it that way? So there's no learning from USCIS. You only find out yes or no, and then you have to reapply.
Okay. One last question on COVID. I don't know whether this is a temporary issue or whether this will actually be brought up. Obviously, since COVID, there has been a change of the way people do work. And so many people are now working from home. And if that starts to become a permanent issue, you know, going back to one of the questions we had on the last topics, will this be a problem for the TEA designation?
I don't see anything that would affect the TEA. And as Kim has said, the data is the data. And you can't change the data. Now, it might change, but again, people who are working from home are not construction workers. And tech doesn't sell in this business anyway. So
there's a change going on there, Scott. I think you're going to see a change because we've been inundated with tech projects. And I think there is a move against, you know, the more counter-cyclical type of project. And I think you are going to see the more non-traditional construction type projects coming into the market.
Well, that may be because we, you know, there have been some fundamental changes.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I agree. I don't really see working from home being something that's going to become a big TEA business or problem, I should say, because the types of projects that we see. And as you say, there could be a shift in that. However, when you think about it from a job creation perspective, you know, an economic consulting firm isn't a great investment for EB-5 funds. So, you know, whatever it is, there it has to be the kind of business that is suitable for job creation. And if we're moving away from construction, then you know, you're basically looking at revenue only. I just think that we won't get too far away from where we are just because of the way the jobs are calculated and the way you get the most jobs for EB-5 investors.
Kim, that really brings me to a question I wanted to ask all three of you. And you've already alluded to this, Scott. There are three types of methodologies which have traditionally been used. You have the REDINE, the RIMS-2, and the IMPLAN. And I know you, all three of you, do not really use the REDINE. But what are your thoughts for the listeners out there who really don't understand anything about the three of them? Well, why would you say RIMS-2 would be better than IMPLAN, or why is IMPLAN and RIMS-2 better than REDINE, or whatever? Dave?
Yeah, they're essentially just three different economic impact or input-output modeling tools. From what I've seen, I haven't really seen that big a preference between RIMS-2, which is what we normally use, and IMPLAN, which is used in a few cases from a USCIS perspective. It does seem that RIMS-2 is kind of the industry standard. As we've seen little bits of training material from USCIS, they tend to mention RIMS-2, but we've never had any problems with them kind of not understanding IMPLAN either. I mean, I would say that IMPLAN does have more categories than RIMS, which can be helpful in certain cases. So I actually looked it up before this podcast. There's 372 different industries in RIMS and 536 in IMPLAN. So there could be a case like, say, with, you know, where RIMS groups together electric power generation as one category. IMPLAN will have a different multipliers for solar versus wind, et cetera. So there could be a case where, you know, there's really more jobs that might be generated by, say, a specific sort of power project. In that case, it might make more sense to use IMPLAN. But by and large, they're doing the same thing where they're taking the inputs and determining what will be the number of jobs and the output and income, et cetera, created, you know, by this economic activity.
Kim, would you say that you get the least amount of jobs from RIMS-2?
No, not at all. But it kind of depends on the economist and how they approach it. RIMS and IMPLAN are generally very consistent, the numbers and the multipliers. Dave makes a really good point about maybe being able to get down to a finer industry level. It can also sometimes be hard with RIMS, and it would be the same for IMPLAN too. So if you focus on, you purchase your RIMS based on a specific geographic area that's appropriate for your project, but maybe your project's the first one in that industry in the area, then you get the multipliers and all of a sudden there's zeros all the way across the page for your particular industry. It's like, oh my goodness, we really are the first one in the area. So, you know, things like that can be, you have to get a little more creative. But I would say as far as REMS versus implant. I do use REMS. And the reason is, well, first, it's very transparent and USCIS adjudicators can understand it. And I know they can because I'm the one that taught them how to understand it. When I worked there, I went out to California and I took the head of the REMS department with me. And we went out and we were there for a week training adjudicators on how to use REMS. And the other thing that I do is I include my REMS, all of it, in with every one of my reports, because that helps USCIS. When I was there, we didn't have a budget to buy REMS to double check, you know, if they were correct from what the economist was saying. We had no idea. So a couple of times they comped us a set of REMS out of the REMS department. But, you know, just like USCIS is fee-based, so is the REMS department at the BEA. And so we include ours to help the adjudicators out. Maybe they can peek at ours for finding a multiplier that they need to figure out a different project.
Oh, so I have a question for all of you. So as you know, you must have heard all of us complaining because we didn't hear from USCIS in 2019. And then this year, we feel like all USCIS did in 2019 was put RFEs together. And but one of the issues, because now we're seeing a number of 829 RFEs as well as 526 RFEs, can you use, say, the original project documents used a REMS too, and you are dangerously short of jobs for the 829? Can you use a different methodology, like an implant methodology, for the 829, and give USCIS that?
This is Scott. The short answer is no. I mean, the only time we've made changes in the model at all was if the previous economist was not going to be used going forward or was no longer working in this field, or they just changed completely the project, I mean, and wanted to take a different approach. Then you can say, hey, we're starting all over. We've been hired to redo this because there might have been some issues or something like that.
Well, Scott, since you mentioned taking over an economic analysis from a previous economist, could you talk about why implant might have higher multipliers than, say, REMS? Because it sounds like that could be a change that a newer economist might make over a previous economist.
One of the reasons that implant has slightly higher, mainly induced multipliers, is that it has the government as well as the household sectors. And as Dave and Kim had said, there is a finer tuning. Like, they have like 8 different construction sectors. The wholesale is now about 8 or 9, and the same thing for retail. But the main difference that I have to complain about, but we use implant almost exclusively unless we're doing 829 work for a previous REMS study project. And in that case, most of the NCEs and the developers want to use the original methodology, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But the main difference is implant is really, really expensive. it hurts me to pay money, but it is the fact, like, just if you want to buy the whole country, it's like $50,000.
Oh, wow.
and you know, like, but that's every county in every state. Most of the projects that we're working on are California, Florida, New York, and Texas.
Yeah. But Scott, that gives me a question, that how often should a project then update their econ report?
I would say anytime there's a significant change, such as, you know, a change in the spending pattern or, you know, the construction, or let's say that they were adding. I mean, we've really had projects where hotels that they decided, okay, we're not getting enough jobs. And so what we're going to do, instead of having the top floors be just regular rooms, they're going to be luxury suites. And so they change the design, which is a legitimate change.
Yeah, but that could also be a material change. So we have to be very careful.
No. I mean, we'd come up with a job estimate and they'd say, that's not enough. We want more. And so they'd say, what can we do? Well, you know, you can build different rooms. You can add more restaurants and things like that, if they're going to make it. And they did make it. They've been very successful in doing that. But generally speaking, I would say anytime there's a significant change in construction or construction materials, or if they have increased the revenue through, let's say, better rooms or luxurious rooms and or more income from the restaurants and et cetera, But aside from that, and that would be prior to submitting to USCIS, really you only need to do it once a year, because that's my opinion, when you want to do the job creation.
Well, Kim, I'm going to direct this question to you because I know you've worked on a project like this. There are still projects out there where the original documents were formulated and crafted back in 2012 or 13, or, you know, some time ago, and then they were not updated for many years for fear of perhaps creating a material change or having USCIS change their adjudication pattern. Should those type of projects get updated econ reports?
It depends on the submission. I have seen some that the original project documents would not be approvable today by any stretch. And they received an exemplar approval. And then later on, USCIS comes back and goes, wait, we're not going to defer to that because those were deficient to begin with. So that is a real problem. And in that case, most definitely, they should update all project documents to be approvable. But, you know, one of the things that we do, we have some clients with very, very large projects. These clients have us do updates, job count updates, using actual numbers on a quarterly basis. And those are not for USCIS. That's just for their own internal reporting. And it works out kind of nicely because then we're set up really well to provide the information required in the 924A filing for those clients every year. So I highly recommend that.
You know, there has been a change. I know you were talking about some of those large projects, Kim, but you know that recently the change in the market has been that projects are much smaller. And many a time, some of the developers and the investors also own the project. And one of the common questions that we get is whether or not land can be purchased through using EB-5 money. Now, we explain each and every time that land cannot be counted towards job creation, but can you use EB-5 money to purchase land if there's enough jobs? Dave?
As you just said, Mona, because it's not an EB-5 eligible expenditure, you're kind of going down a slippery slope if you start using, you know, non-EB-5 eligible expenditures for using EB-5 money for those, right? So the cleanest way to do it is you use your EB-5 money for your EB-5 expenses. You're going to need other funds in there anyway. Nothing is going to be exclusively funded by EB-5. My recommendation would be to then use your non-EB-5 funds for things like land, which cannot be counted towards job creation.
I would add in there, yes, they can use it to buy land, but it, as Dave says, it's not going to be used for the job creation. And, you know, which money is used? I mean, it's almost laughable on the 924A form these days. They want you to identify what industry the EB-5 money went into.
Oh, yeah, that was new. That just came in the end of last year. We all freaked out when we saw that.
It's impossible. Yeah. You know, in other words, are you telling me I need to ask the developer what percent of that dollar went into that laborer over there or the wood for the construction? I mean, it's impossible to do.
I think it's important to understand there's a difference between using EB-5 capital for an expenditure or whether an expenditure is allowable in the model. These are two totally different things. We exclude a bunch of things from our model, land included, that you could spend the EB-5 capital to pay for. You know, I think a lot of people get confused on the two issues. The baseline of your question was, can you use EB-5 capital to purchase land if there's enough jobs? And the answer is yes. If you've got enough jobs, that means you've got enough non-EB-5 money coming into the project. And it really doesn't matter whether the EB-5 capital goes to the land or to the, you know, 2x4s and sheetrock. It's all the same thing to build the project. So I would say as long as you have enough jobs, then you can do that. But you cannot use EB-5 capital to pay for any EB-5 expenses like us.
That's a question I was going to ask you guys. So what are the typical expenses that cannot be counted?
So those would be contingencies, all EB-5 expenses, including economists and immigration attorneys, and then, you know, permitting, any kind of...
Are you saying permits, Scott? You can't use EB-5 money for permits? I thought you could.
No, not permitting or anything, because there's already people working in those facilities, the government offices, et cetera. And so none of those types of things. Now, you can use contingencies if they're actually spent, construction contingencies, but anything that's a transfer payment is what we refer to it, that doesn't actually create jobs. So taxes, permitting, land, of course, which we've just said, the purchase of any kind of like the building or the purchase of the land, et cetera, you cannot count.
Okay, thanks.
And to that point, just to add one point, sometimes,
sure, Dave.
Yeah, we definitely cannot include contingencies at the outset. Sometimes as the project is wrapping up, I still say, well, we don't want to include that contingency because it could be a red flag for USCIS, even though the money was spent. You know, what was it spent on? And please recategorize it there so that it's clear that, oh, okay, it was spent on this specific construction activity, you know, rather than reporting, say, in your 829 as, you know, $10 million on contingency, which could get potentially result in an RFE.
So I've got a question for the other economists, because USCIS will never tell us. There are some items that we usually, not usually, we religiously do not include. And those would be interest on bank payments or any kind of banking, which I think we could, but we just think it's too risky. And also insurance, which by and large, that money is going to some big underwriter in New York or something like that. So do you guys include interest? And you know, we're not talking about EB-5 interest, but interest as in bank lending and or insurance?
Yeah, we don't include those either.
I do. I'm the outlier here. For as far as financing goes, to the extent we have detail available, and you guys know how hard it can be to get details, we include non-EB-5 interest payments. And we have had approvals all the way to the 829 on that. And same with insurance. Haven't had any question about either one of those. Of course, I tend to start by justifying what I'm including in my report, but haven't had any trouble.
Well, Kim, wouldn't it matter what industry it was? Say, for example, insurance may not be as important in one industry, but say, for example, transportation, it's mandatory to have insurance. Wouldn't that be a cost that you would have to take into account?
Yes, but other people aren't including it for job creation purposes. And
I see.
And we do. I mean, it's a legitimate expense. It's not a transfer payment. So we just include it and they have accepted it.
Yeah, and I would agree that it is a legitimate expense, but then you think, okay, these guys, the client, of course, wants no trouble. We just figure at some point, some items in the development budget and or the operating budget are worth the risk and others are not. And so insurance tends not to be that high of a dollar amount. Banking can be.
Yeah.
I mean, we included insurance on one project where the insurance was like $120 million. So obviously it was pretty big.
One thing I would like to point out as far as financing, and this goes back to something I said earlier, everything I do in my submissions to USCIS, I look for a way to justify it, you know, the reasonable economic methodologies. And financing is actually one of the items included in the RIMS handbook bill of goods example. So that's
is there a dummy's
solid
guide to that?
Yeah, that's pretty solid. I think that USCIS couldn't really question that if the BEA is using it as an example.
Mm. Well, one of the interesting things that we have seen on RFEs, and we're in that lucky position where we see a lot of RFEs because we do a lot of co-counseling, are questions relating to NAICS codes, where their wrong codes have been named. So I wanted to ask all of you about that, because I feel like that's one area that people really do overlook.
I've actually only had one case where we got an RFE regarding the wrong NAICS code. We didn't completely agree with the rationale, but we thought, the multiplier is similar. I can see the case for it. So we changed that to the NAICS code they recommended, and that was that. So I don't know about Scott and Kim or Mona, if you've seen that come up a lot, but generally we haven't seen challenges to the NAICS codes we've assigned.
Well, one issue that I would like to say is, and I haven't seen it either. I think we might have had one RFE the RFE was on a number of other issues and they mentioned something about a NAICS code. And I think we just had the wrong number. We just made an honest error. But most of the time, the real crux of the issue for the economist, we assign NAICS codes after the fact. What we're usually doing is taking every line item of the construction budget and the operating budget, the income statement, and we're assigning that to IMPLAN and or RIMS industry sector codes. And then once we do all that and run our analysis and sum up on all those industry sectors, then we go back and say, okay, what does this industry sector match up for with the NAICS code?
So panel, we've seen a huge increase in entrepreneurial projects, and I'm sure we're going to see more as the amount is so much higher and people are trying to do their own projects. Many projects come to us and say, oh, we have no problem in creating the jobs. And then the jobs, because they're direct, don't get created. So have you seen lawyers or developers or investors coming to you for assistance on non-regional center type projects? Kim?
You wouldn't have an economic report on a non-regional center type project, but we have helped a number of direct investors, whether they're individual or pooled, with their submissions, making sure that they're written in a way that's understandable by the adjudicators. And one of the other kind of cool things that you can do is use multipliers to back up what they're saying.
So I noticed this. Can you explain that a little more?
Well, one of the things that we've done is, say it's a hotel in Miami, we can go look at the multiplier for running a hotel in Miami and back into the numbers and say, well, the BEA says this is how many direct jobs this industry should have at a certain revenue level and so forth. So we can back into the numbers that way. And USCIS does that in-house to double check things as well.
Yeah, I have noticed that. Dave, Scott?
Yeah, that's one thing we do in our reports as much as we can, which is kind of show that, you know, the two numbers align. Like, for example, if it's, say, an assisted living facility and they have both projected revenue and expected number of employees, you can kind of, you know, use the multipliers both ways to show that the things align. And I think that just makes a stronger case.
Scott?
As Kim said, all of the projects that are direct don't need an economic study. You only need an economic study for job creation within a regional center or underneath the wings of a regional center. But we've also used this same methodology for national interest waiver and other types of employment within the immigration business.
So, panel, we brought up magic wands earlier and magic dust and whatever. Now I'm actually going to give each one of you a magic wand, and I'm going to ask you to make one wish, just in case there's anybody from that neck of the woods in DC listening, and they might just listen to your wish. So, Kim, I'm going to give you a magic wand. What is your wish?
I wish that Congress would agree on something. I really don't care what new TEA legislation looks like. Just tell us what you want, put it onto paper, vote on it, and let's move on. This is a great program, especially now. We obviously are having a tough time in our national or worldwide economy. It would be really great to use this as the awesome economic development tool that it is. So please agree and vote and move on.
That's a really good point. And, you know, one of our podcasts, we were looking at the numbers, you know, US versus the rest of the world. And US, it just every year, it's so many more investment investors who come into the US than other countries. And if we had more visas, we could do so much more, mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
Economists are great at modeling financial and economic uncertainty, not so much on regulation and legislation uncertainty.
Dave, your magic wand or your magic dust.
Yeah, I'd like to get more transparency around what's allowable and what's not. Right? There's some guidance provided by USCIS, but so much of it is, you know, you try things and you try to use what makes sense. And then once in a while, you maybe get an RFE on some issue, which, you know, you submitted the same issue hundreds of times and gotten approvals, but this one adjudicator had concern with it.
He might've just had a bad lunch that day.
That could be, but it would be helpful for everybody in the industry, not just the economists, but for the people doing projects to know what expenses can be included and without having to sort of take this hit or miss approach, or actually end up being overly conservative, because the last thing we want to do is include something and then have the whole project be subject to an RFE because, you know, we attempted to include a category that was kind of on the margin.
Hmm. That's a good one.
It sounds like Dave is used to dealing with the multipliers in RIMS 2 or M plan, but RFE multipliers aren't in there, shouldn't be in there. He just wants guidance. It should right. be a 1, not a 0 or a 0.65, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, Dave, I would say in cases like that, USCIS should really give us more RFCs where you could just email a response rather than subject everybody to RFEs and clarifications, you know, request for clarification. And USCIS have been doing that by just emailing when there's only just one or two small issues rather than subjecting reams and reams of paper and wastages of time and money and everything for many different investors.
So in lieu of broad guidance, which would help everybody, have that which would help one person, one case. Yeah. I like Dave's request.
So Scott, what would you want? Magic dust or a magic wand?
Okay. I would have a wand and dust, and I would go more global in nature. And more towards what Kim was saying. Number one, eliminate the backlog and get the Chinese market back to where it was, where it's now at least, it's probably 25% of what it was before. And that's mainly because of the backlog of 15 years or so. I'm sure it's gone down lately. So number one, fix the backlog. Number two, add to the number of visas or don't make them. I mean, I think the original intent was 10,000 visas, and those were supposed to be investors, and then their families and were supposed to be coming in as well, but not counted under that 10,000. And number three, so make the 10,000 the investors.
Didn't I say one wish?
Hey, somebody gave him a genie's lamp here. Was that an option?
No. It's all about revising the program. Making the program work for in today's environment. And then the third thing would be, if there are any unused visas, roll them forward like other plans have.
Well, this certainly has been an enlightening panel discussion regarding economics. And I want to thank Kimberly Atterbury, Dave Evans, and Scott Barnhart for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you for having us on. I really appreciate it. It was fun to talk to everyone.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to the podcast. Enjoyed the discussion and hope this is useful for folks listening to it.
Yes, thank you for having this and putting this on. I'm hoping that a lot of people can learn from this because I've learned something from the other participants as well.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.